Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey, Straight No Chaser. What a treat I have for you all who are listening this evening. Of course, first, before we get to that wonderful treat, I have to do a little housekeeping. So those of us who are, and the board is filling up, thank you all for calling in. Those of you who have not been on the program before, let me tell you that you are listening to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. We are on blogtalkradio.com/S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. If you from now on want to listen to this or any of the other 99 episodes, then you can call this number and pick out, scroll down what you want. If you are on the board today and you have a question or want to make a comment, all you have to do is press the number 1. The number that you call in, for those of you who are listening on other devices, is 516-453-6063. And with that, I come to an end of some of my housekeeping for this evening. Now, to my guest, my wonderful, I think, inspiring guest. There is a group at the Siloam, thank you, Presbyterian Church, that, and this particular group is called the Dr. Edith Rock Workshop for Elders. It is sponsored by the Center of Black Literature at Medgar Evers College. Now, let me just say, I was curious because it had such a distinctive name. I wanted to find out a little bit more about Edith Rock. So let me tell you a little bit about the woman that this group was named for. She was born in Virginia. She moved to Mount Clair, New Jersey, in very early in life in 1947. She was born in 1938. She and her brother moved to Mount Clair. She went to Mount Clair High School, and then she got a BA and master's and PhD at NYU, and then she was a longtime faculty member of Medgar Evers College. I think it's only proper that we give homage to the person whose name is on the group so that we can know where we are. And now to two of the members that belong to this writing group, what I've asked about this, and it's so interesting when you write, when you ask writers to write about themselves, it's always interesting what they write and how colorful they are or how distinctively sharp and razor sharp they are about the information. I'm going to first start with William Craig. Mr. Craig was born and raised and bred, as he said, in Brooklyn with a lineage that encompasses both Caribbean and indigenous American. He is a husband, a father, a brother, a cousin, and a friend. It seems that his passion for writing was probably started along when he was quite young, and he has a way, it hit him that my words and thoughts were as valuable as those of anyone else. So it was then that my journey to express my freedom took form. Now from there, I'm going to stop because I think I have a page full of questions for William Craig to find out how he discovered that his voice and his words were as important and as valuable as anyone else. So I would like to say hello to William Craig before I introduce my other guest. So, Bill Craig, hello.
Good evening. Hope all is well.
Good evening. How interesting it is for you to describe yourself like that. And I am going. I have a bevy of questions to ask you about your childhood, about the people who influenced you, about how you came to that conclusion. But before I do that, we both know that the next guest that I have demands that I get to her before too late. And Miss Sylvia Jones, and now let me say this as correctly as I possibly can because I've already mispronounced one thing. Sue Eskun.
Yes, you're doing it
born,
right.
Thank you. In Freeman's Hospital in Washington, D.C., she was a member of the 1950 graduating class of Dunbar High, and she attended, and that was in Washington, D.C. She attended Morgan State University, where she earned her Bachelor of Science degree, and then she pursued her graduate studies at Fordham University. Vocation. She, for many years, worked as a therapeutic recreational director for health and hospital coordination in New York City before she retired. Her father, Herbert Harris Jones Sr., was a musical director for over 50 years, and music was always an important part of her life. So music is a constant in her home, and she sang in choruses all her life. So art is a part of her life. We haven't touched in her bio how writing became an intricate part of what she does now, especially in this group, but we will. But without further ado, would you please say hello, Miss Sylvia Jones?
Well, hello, everybody. How are you today?
Well, I think that they are quite fine. I think it's wonderful. Thank you, first of all, for both of you coming in to expose the audience, I think, to something that not a lot of people know. First of all, I think that we are in a society that does not recognize the fact that past 45, there is a great, wonderful life that one enjoys. And one can choose all of those years, all the experiences that you had all of those years before, as a wonderful rainbow of choices to use and to mature and to grow into in the years that follow 45 and 55. So I have to ask you, the connection to the Presbyterian Church, the connection to Medgar Evers College, how, and I'm going to ask you first, Ms. Sylvia, how did you become connected to this group?
Are you talking about the church or are you talking about the writers group?
I'm talking about the writers group.
Okay. Well, the writers group, Edith Rock Writing Group, she wrote the proposal for it. It was discussed in a group that we call the Forum Committee. The Forum mm-hmm. Committee has always put on certain programs and things so people were able to talk about things of interest. For instance, we used to have a forum about seeing your physician. We had forums about, forums dealing with conversation circles to find out what people needed at our particular church. So what happened, Edith was a well-read person, and she felt that we needed, that the black people needed to write their own stories. And, you know, this came about around the time when Camille Cross Cosby started the program. And so it was discussed in the forum committee, and Edith was on faculty there at Medgar Evers, and she wrote the proposal, and the proposal for the group was accepted. So therefore, that's how we started. And I started to write, really, because of that, We had wonderful workshop leaders and a variety of workshop leaders. We had one was a editor from Simon & Schuster, and we've had many authors. Donna, I'm trying to remember Donna's last name, Craig Quick. Donna was one of our workshop leaders. There was
Donna Hill?
Yes. And mm-hmm. there was Nellie mm-hmm. Rosario, and the first one was Malika. So we've had several workshop leaders, and I think that we had had a variety of interesting workshops. And we're brand new with starting to write, as I was, as far as to doing creative writing. And I think that it had been a learning situation for us. And I think that we were able to bring those memories. I remember my first piece that I wrote was it was suggested that we pick a photograph that we enjoyed looking at. And it was really my first trip away from our home with a family trip up to Philadelphia and to Atlantic City. And I found it quite interesting to be able to put those memories down. And one of the things we always knew that black people had so many different experiences, and that this is why it was so important that each person write about their lives. I think many of us had been through we were around when World War II started, and when Martin Luther King died, and we could really write our real feelings and really what happened to us at that particular time.
Well, let me stop you right here, because that phrase of it is really great, but what were you doing that made you eligible for this workshop before? You said it was proposed by Dr. Rock. What was your affiliation to the environment before? So you were there before. What were you doing there then? Were you a member of the forum? Were you what was your position then?
I was a member of the forum mm-hmm. committee. I've been a member of Siloam Presbyterian Church, and mm-hmm. yeah. So that's what happened, and so we talked about it, and
so
people decided to come. I'm sorry.
So what I'm trying to establish for the audience is the progression of how this all started. So it started in the church because you were a member of the church, and the connection
within that forum committee. Within that committee,
okay.
When you're on a committee in church, you throw around, you have ideas. And that was one of the
mm-hmm.
ideas, and it had been discussed by the group. And then Edith wrote the proposal.
Was Dr. Rock in the group, or was she proposed
Edith,
to be
it? Well, Edith and Edith Rock and was the chair of the committee at that time.
Okay.
She was in
right.
the group.
Okay.
These
so,
are people
mm-hmm.
that we know.
Okay.
These are people that I know and know
mm-hmm.
very well. Craig
okay.
also knew her very well. So it's not the idea
yes.
that it was
right.
somebody that, you know, we all work together in the church.
All right. So now I'm going to go to you, Bill. How
yes.
did your connection happen? Now, Sylvia Jones was in the committee. Were you in the committee? How did you come to be a part of this?
Not at the beginning. I was very
mm-hmm.
much aware of Edith Rock. She was a wonderful teacher, friend, mother, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And Sylvia, mm-hmm. Sylvia, I've known since, let's just say, I was a younger man, because I'm still young at this point. My family is historically the oldest family in the church right now.
Exactly.
Goes back to 1862 or 1852, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I've done some of the research.
Mm-hmm.
How I became
mm-hmm.
a member of the group was I am male. This group was primarily a group of females. And in my mind, jokingly, whenever, you know, this female group needed some male expression. So I said, hey, I want to be a member of the group. So now you have an estrogenic approach, and now you have an androgenic approach. Of course, we all think differently, men and women, and I understand that. From that point, I started with the group. I believe Sylvia was my push into the group. She said, you're not doing anything. Come on and be a part of the group. So I became a part of the group.
How long had the group been established?
I would say 7 years, six or seven years before me. I'd have to ask Sylvia, basically, because she is the, you know, she's the timekeeper, so to speak, you know. And that's how I started with the group.
I want to establish also how writing became a part of both of your lives. So, Sylvia Jones? Tell me the first indication that you thought that, as Bill said, that your words were as important as anyone else's, and it was important for you to put it down. Not the recognition that Black people needed to have a recording or things. I know that. I'm talking about your individual, the moment when you thought, well, yes, this is possible. When do you recall that?
Not really, because I think I started to write because of the group, because the group had been established, and I was going to the workshops. So that's when I really started to do writing per se, other than doing proposals and whatever, you know, work kinds of stuff. And, you know, I journaled prior to that, but I had not thought in terms of publishing or anything of that sort. That had not been my forte at all. And the workshop was the impetus for me to start writing.
I see. So writing was not a part of the artistic endeavor like music was for you.
Not like singing and not like painting.
Okay. Okay. All right. What about you, Bill?
I did not see it as an artistic endeavor. I saw it as a way of expressing my point of view, my value, my my understanding. The first time I encountered this was I needed an extra credit course to finish my degree. So I took the writing course. And sadly, I entered into a course at Columbia run by a man who saw writing in one way, one direction. And we bumped heads 1,000 times because he wanted to talk about or write about something, and I would take his subject and twist it around. Now, he couldn't fail me because the piece I wrote was so different and just off the page, but he was angry that I used his thought and twisted it around. That's when I realized that I could write anything I wanted to write in any way I wanted to write, whether people understood it or not. And that's when it started. The other incident was when I read in the New York Times the somewhat story about the riots at Columbia University. I read the story and I wondered where those riots were, because I was standing there. Someone interpreted it and put it in the New York Times as something that happened, and I couldn't believe that they actually got away with that. So you can write something and change it any way you want to change it, whether it's true or false. And that to me was... it was disturbing at the best, at the least, I should say.
So
I read.
When you say,
go on, Lenny.
No. When you say that you were standing there, in other words, their interpretation of what was going on and what you saw were two different things, And so the interpretation of what they said was a riot and what you saw was not, is that what you're indicating? Or
that is absolutely what I'm indicating. That is absolutely what I'm indicating. First of all, it wasn't a riot. I was standing when the horseman, the policeman on a horse, charged into a group on the horse. And yes, people got hurt. And then someone called it a riot. It wasn't a riot. It was the fact that people were scampering, getting away from that horseman, that cop who didn't care, and charged into the group on his horse. That's when I realized that someone saw it totally different than what had actually happened.
I have to say that I have history with the usage of that word dealing with the Greenwood, Oklahoma situation, in that the survivors, and I think there's only one or two left now, don't refer to it as a riot. They refer to it as a disturbance, or many other words. But a riot indicates somehow that there was an aggression put upon, that there was an aggression by the civilians on something, someone else. And so an interpretation of a word is a very important thing. So I will say to both of you how important it is that the accuracy of words is interpreted by those of us who experience it the way we experience it. Now, going in that direction, let me ask you, how long have both of you been in this workshop, and how has it evolved for you in your writing sense? Why don't I start with you, Ms. Sylvia?
We started in 2003, so that's given that we've had quite a bit of time to have been in we call it the workshop. And I think many of the people prior to now were starting to write. They had, you know, they had written at other times, but as far as, you know, education, as far as, but they had not been, it had not been their thrust to write books or to write whatever. But the memoir writing group was a lot of our first times actually doing writing to be published. Now we have people who have published within our group, and it's a learning experience. But it's been going on since that time, since 2003.
And so the evolution has been that you started more simply in memoirs and unpublished, and then now you have published writers in your group.
Yeah, these are people who have joined, you know, they've joined through Zoom, and they have joined, you know, especially now since the pandemic. We've got a lady in from South Dakota, and we have a lady in Florida. These are people who came in. We've had several people who've come in through the, you know, after hearing the group present at the Black Writers Conference. We've had several people who had joined who were not necessarily, you know, new writers, who were basically old writers. But the great majority of us, we were memoir writers. And that's the way we started off, reading memoirs, and that was what we were doing, writing our history. And not just we enjoy the idea of being able to express ourselves in writing, but we were not the published authors that we now have, you know, within the group.
Bill, how long did you? If it started in 2003, did you start it in 2010? Maybe.
I would probably say about 2010, around there. Yes.
I've been writing
all along. But go on. Go on.
No. Well, how has your writing evolved? You know, and I'm listening to Ms. Sylvia. She told me, you know, the arc of her journey there. How has your writing evolved?
I would say I have learned. I think a point you made about the use of particular words and what they create, what kind of mindset they create. I have learned to make sure, try and make sure that when I am using a word, that I am creating exactly what I want to be, how I want that word to be thought of. Now, I've also learned that people will think of anything they want to learn, but it's my responsibility to be as clear in my description of something that I evoke exactly what I want to evoke. Thanks be to the people who have been training me to be clearer in my sentence formation and the words I use, and even in my punctuation. I've done a little bit better. Now, I could go off the scale and start talking about something crazy, but at least it's correctly done. Okay, that's the point. So,
I see what you're talking about. You bring up an important point that I want to ask both of you about, the responsibility of the writer. The responsibility, because I don't know if you know, the last 2 weeks I had Melba Tolliver, who opened my show 2 years ago. And since we celebrated 2 years anniversary, she came back. And who I think is one of the most responsible journalists. She's so very, very careful about how she puts things down, and careful about how she precedes them. What do you feel about the responsibility of being a writer and carrying on the message of memoir writing? Because what happens is that you really become our memories for us. After we're gone, your writing becomes the picture that people see. How do you take on that responsibility as a writer, especially a memoir writer? Ms. Sylvia?
Well, I try to be as clear and concise as possible, and I'm trying to figure out. Well, I think that's one of the things. And then the workshop is the helper that helps me to clarify that if I'm writing something, people have to understand what it is and hear what it is, what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I see it. Yeah.
All right, Bill.
First of all, it is critical that a writer own up to what they're putting down, because they are creating thoughts in people. And if you want to create the wrong thought, first of all, do writers have agendas? What is the agenda of the writer? Is the agenda of the writer trying to get you to think in a particular way? Is he wants to control? So I think that how a writer takes on that responsibility depends on their agenda, first of all. And sometimes agendas are negative. But that's the responsibility. I also believe that how we use it, how we bring it forward, is a critical way as well. I'm trying to capture a thought that just came through as Sylvia was speaking. We have a responsibility. We create history. I can create the history of today, and however I want to spin it. If I want you to be sorry, if I want you to give me some money, if I want you to stand up and shout, I could spin it any way I want to do. It's my agenda. Is there an ethic in writing? Absolutely. To deny the ethical importance of it, I think one lies to themselves. And sadly, there's so much that we have read, and let's use the word. You used the word early in the beginning, Lenny. His story. Whose story? Do I want to write his story, or do I want to write the story of what is actually happening? Sadly, we've been reading his story as opposed to our own story, and that is critical. I have young kids believing in things which is surreal, because they read it somewhere, and they read it because the guy had an agenda to create that thought in that child. And sadly, it's not often a positive thought.
Now that you brought that up, I've got so many questions here. I don't know if I'm going to get to them all, but because you all keep feeding me into things that I don't want to lose the thought. so I don't want to veer away just because I have a question of it. How do you both feel about the way things are written now? I know I asked that a little bit of Melba. She stays away, she strategically stays away from criticism because she's, of course, in the business of journalism, and so many of the people that we are talking about and referring to are people she's known all her life. But being away from it, but being a part of that advocation of writing, when you hear an interpretation of on the news, when you read an excerpt, what comes to mind now that you are now doing this as such a important component of your life? Do you read it differently? Do you have questions that are different than you did before you started the workshop 20 years ago? Ms. Sylvia?
Well, I'd like to, you know, we call it, title has been Tales of Our Times, and it's a matter of writing up historical things as they were. And I think that it's passing it down as history to our young people. And this is how I view what should be done, my writing to be. Because I think that this is what's lacking now, that our young people don't have a good grasp on the history of us as black people.
Do you think that as Bill referred to, do you think that is attributed to the fact that a lot of the things that they have heard have been written, and a lot of the things that they have read have an agenda of a certain slant of our history?
Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm. And I agree. And this is why we were writing. And this is exactly mm-hmm. why we were writing. Because there have been agendas, and this has been, and things have been distorted through the years, and a lot of people who are doing writing that's supposed to be black history have done research, did not really live the experience.
I'd like to say this. I'm going to veer away from you all just for a second. The board is full, so I'm so sorry. But people who want to try to get in, there's no room on the board. So thank
really?
You very much for thank you very much for calling in and listening and being a wonderful audience. And if you have a question, we only have about 20 minutes left. See, it goes really quick. So you better get that number one, put it up quickly, because, I have lots of questions, and I'm going to try to get some of mine in. One of the things that that I wanted to kind of veer away from what we were talking about, but I think that is important, is the effect of inaccuracies of history on our young people, and and how we can more diligently attack that when there is a movie maybe that is not accurate, that is written by somebody who does not have our investment in mind. Do we write about that? Do we critique that? How do you think, being a generation, being of a generation that was very, very active, that was very vocal about who we wanted to be in the 60s and 70s, the 50s and 60s and 70s, and formulating what that is about, do you think that there's a certain method that we can help our young people try to understand more about who they are and where they come from? If you see something that's inaccurate, how would you attack that? Bill.
Sadly and truthfully, it really starts at home. Because if I'm not monitoring what my son is reading or hearing, or listening to. I am letting him be influenced by the forces which are outside of the house, which are usually have their own purpose, own agenda, which for the most part is contrary to a well-balanced, respectful, educated child. So I have to be aware of what's going on in his life. And if some people say, well, he doesn't talk to me, or she doesn't talk to me, somehow, some way, we need to create a language or how can I say, a space where they can feel safe in talking to you about anything that they see, feel, hear, or touch. Because they're being bombarded with this media thing, which is absolutely extraordinary because it's every day. And most of the stuff that's coming through, and I know Melba didn't maybe want to talk about it, but it was not designed to bring forth information. It's designed to sensationalize something, which will build your interest to go out and buy whatever needs to be bought that they're selling at this point. Sensationalism as opposed to truth. So we have to be cognizant and have to be on it almost 24/7 because it is real. It is a real force out there, and we cannot leave our kids just hanging in the wind because the wind will carry them away.
I have had the privilege of several times on YouTube, not live, but on YouTube, to listen to the stories. And I want to get to this because that's why I'm having you back next week, because I wanted everyone to understand this week your passion, your dedication, your the focus on the point of view of how accuracy and memory are so important to our culture, to every culture. And in particular, the Black culture that has been represented by people who don't have, as I've said before, the same investment that we do have. And I have to say to you all that when one listens to these stories, ladies and gentlemen, all of you who are listening, it is like a painting of a picture. You are transported back in time to when some of the people talk about when they were younger and they were sick with the cold and what was happening with them and the people outside. And you are transported to where this is happening and why a lot of the things that we practice, where those things came from. So with that in mind, I will say to you too, have you thought about what you might be reading from next week when we bring you back to read parts of your work and then have the audience then be able to ask you questions about it? Have you thought about which parts of your, which works that you've written over the years that I've enjoyed a great deal of the stories, really, that you think might be representative of your work? Have you thought about that? Bill?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There's no question about that. And one of the things you just said about words paint a picture. Sometimes, as opposed to writing, I paint. And that paint, that paint becomes a writing.
Writing.
You know, I am writing with paint. So I'm painting something. Sometimes my wanting to express a point is not only with painting or words, but I want to see something that's a sculpture wise. So I will go out and buy clay and create a sculpture, which I've done. So all of this is trying to bring forth words which will create some kind of positive thought. That's what I do. Absolutely, I've written things which I would like to share with the world. In fact, you know, some of it's poetic, some of it's just an essay of sorts, but whatever. I am speaking to something which has happened in my life, in my mind, in my heart, and I'm trying to bring it through.
Ms. Sylvia?
Yeah, I was thinking about a couple of things that I might want to present. I think one of the things was from our last publication. It was a letter to America. That was one of them that was dealing with what I would say to America, what we need. And then another one that I think I had presented at, was it Poets and Writers? Yeah, that presented at Poets and Writers was, I think it was What's in a Name, and we were dealing with Black history about What's in a Name. That was I'd written that a while ago. Yeah.
I have to say that, I'm now telling the board, you have about 15 minutes left. If you have any questions, if you want to continue listening, that's fine. But let us try to get the questions in now, so you can get an adequate answer to your questions. And then, of course, we're going to go on to the webinar, which I hope that you all have received the link for and are welcome as attendees to come in. And if you have not, if you are on Facebook, you can go to Lenny Godfrey Facebook, and the webinar link is there, and you can click on it there. Now, we will be picking that up directly after this, and it's only about 10-15 minutes, but I look forward to it just continuing the conversations that we have about writing. When I asked you about those kinds of things and exposing, I think, now to an audience that did not know, I did not know that this existed past about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and Melba talked about covering this years ago. She actually covered the writer's event that you all have. I think you just had it. What I want to do is paint a picture for the audience of what a session would be like in these last few minutes when you go to the workshop. You say you have various people who
various
come
leaders.
To the workshop.
We have various people, and then we've had various leaders who brought different brought us different experiences. Now, Donna Hill brought us experiences of fictional writing and things of that sort, and other people brought different experiences to us.
Well, I don't have a distinction between leaders and people. I don't.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I'm saying that this has a bearing. You know, most of the people in our group were not professional writers, and this
mm-hmm.
has a bearing on our writing. That's why I'm bringing that up.
We have to
memoir writers.
What we have to do, you know, Ms. Sylvia, what we have to do is agree to disagree. That's
mm-hmm.
all, and we'll move on.
Fine.
To that.
Yeah.
You know, what I would like is to create for a moment what the workshop process is.
Oh, okay. I hear you and I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well,
go please.
Mm-hmm. Well, we basically read our work and then it's critiqued. The person keeps quiet and then we critique the work. This is what's going on currently in
mm-hmm.
in our workshops. Am I missing anything, Mr. Craig?
I would say that it's absolutely what you're saying, but that's in a general level.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is very, very interesting, Lenny, because if someone is from the Caribbean, and I'm speaking about someone or something that's happening up in Boston, the person from the Caribbean is hearing what I had written, and then she's going to comment on it from her experience, which is
mm-hmm.
what we do, basically. But the point is,
mm-hmm.
if the person who has written it in Boston hears what the person heard, if the person who was in Caribbean heard it, they might not necessarily agree to how the person in Caribbean is looking at it. Maybe that's where we agree to disagree, per se. But
mm-hmm.
it's
mm-hmm.
very different. because we hear what people are saying about something that we wrote through the filter of their lives. And it's interesting. That's very interesting, because someone who lives in North Dakota could hear me speaking about something that happened in Brooklyn, New York, and she responds to that. So I'm getting almost by freedom, by free, a point of view, which I don't have to pay for. All I got to do is listen to it. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So it expands my ability to phrase.
When you all do this, the reading of these works that you've created, have you been assigned a certain thing, a certain subject, a certain category to do it, or do you find that yourself, and do you justify that, why you've written it? Either one can ask.
The task was actually given to all of us. What would you say to America? Letters to America.
Yeah, no, that was.
You should have heard the people.
But that has not been always that we had been able prior to write what we felt that we wanted to write about. But this is why I was saying each time things have been different, and so it's different, and I think it's a wonderful experience. You know.
So you say sometimes you're asked to write. I just want clarification here. Sometimes you're asked to write certain things, and then other times you have in other times the ability to bring to the workshop something that's been on your mind and to justify why you wanted to work
Not only to justify, because what happens if it's not published in our anthology, people are publishing it for, we're seniors. I'm 90 years old. Other people are 90 years old. Some of them, you know, we're leaving this for our families. We're leaving our family history for our families and these experiences. So as memoir writers, you know, not necessarily as other writers, but as memoir writers. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does. Not as a novelist. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
You are recalling it. It is like recall, and you are trying to accurately give a picture of what has happened, and that is like recall. But what I'm trying to fine tune is the freedom that you have. And that's what you're telling me, the two categories, that you do have the freedom to bring something that is memoir, but also that at times you have an assignment. And in that assignment, all right.
Yes.
And that's what, I wanted people to know, because we talk about the workshop, but I wanted them to know what you do in it. And once you've read your work in the workshop, and it is critiqued, what comes after that? Do you write it again? Do you discuss it? What comes after that?
We write it again, because we get the input from the critique from our other members, but we really want them to people to understand what we are writing and to hear and to think in terms of time, think in terms of age, think in terms of a setting and things of that sort. Those things are very, very vital in your writing, so people can see and understand. So there's rewriting that goes on currently, constantly.
So clarification is that not only do you read it for the person who is leading the workshop at the time, but also the members of the workshop have the ability to voice what they think about it?
Oh, definitely, and that's the beauty of it. And just as Bill was saying, that we have people who are from many different places who, you know, they learn about what had happened here. We learn about what has happened in their lives in the Caribbean, or either, you know, different parts of the country or different parts of the world.
Have
One
you
of the
had
things,
Say that again, Bill. Sorry.
I was going to say one of the things that's interesting to me, and I don't know if I've handled it yet in my head. First of all, the group is fantastic. But do I have the responsibility of making something clear to you? Is it my responsibility that you understand some clarity? I would say that I'd like to believe that the education level is equal, if not superior to mine, and I could write anything. But if you are someone who has a second-grade education and I write something and you're mad because you don't understand it, is it my responsibility, if I want to make sure you understand it? And I say sometimes yes and sometimes no.
I think you're thinking more in terms of the creative, you know, you'd be doing the plain creative stuff, and I think I'm thinking in terms of memoir business. I think we're talking about two different things, because I think some of the writings are like paintings. You know, we stand in front of a painting, I say it's wonderful. You look at it and you say, I don't understand it. Okay?
True.
And I think I'm thinking more in terms of the memoir part of it, where we're writing it for clarity for people to understand, especially if we're writing to leave historic information. We want to have it so that people will, okay, are these children 10 years old or are they 15 years old? You know, that kind of thing. You know, when certain things have happened in their lives.
Yeah.
Being specific is a very important thing because, you know, that creates, like I say, you all do paint pictures, and so if you're too broad, the picture isn't as clear. But you know, also, you know what I'm curious about, the ability of people, because we are not a monolithic people. So people come from a lot of different cultures there, and you are reading your work, and someone, I will just throw this out, someone doesn't quite understand the cultural reference that you're making. What adjustments do you make for that? Do you, you know, if someone says, well, what does that mean, a phrase that you do, do you explain it verbally to them, or do you change the work that you
That's a difficult point. That's it. Lenny, that's a difficult point. You know, do we take the time to do that, or do we let it go? Suppose someone used the word gaslighting.
Mm-hmm.
How many people understand that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that's generational in terms of using that word. Maybe it's cultural. Maybe it's ethnic. But. That's a difficult task, Lenny. And if I want to communicate with you, I will make sure that whatever I do or say, I will go out of my way to make sure you hear what I'm saying. So that becomes my responsibility. If I don't care whether you understand me or not, then that's the fact. Then you have to go out of your way to find out where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a double-edged sword.
I see. You know, my reference, the reason why I have such a curiosity about it is I take it from a different point of view is when I'm working with actors and I'm working with text and something is not clear. Like, say, with a writer, with a playwright, do we take on the responsibility of trying to make it clearer, or is it the writer's responsibility to clear up that point? And so I was, you know, from a director's point of view, just trying to find out as writers what procedure it is that you might take in a workshop. And there's no clear yes or no, black and white, but just wondering about the procedure, you know, because in the arts we are, the most important thing I think that we have to do is we create a safe space for creativity. And that when we may not agree or we may not understand something, we do that in a way that is constructively critical, but not offensive, you know, to that. And also, you know, I limit, say, my actors, any critical references that they have to one another's work. that doesn't happen. That is usually something that is something that is my privilege, which is why we are in a workshop. You do have a person who has that voice and that voice of experience that has a bigger picture. So I just wanted to know how your workshop was working and how beautifully that has been interwoven into the process that you have. And so it's something for me to think about. Now, I have to say that we are down to the last, like, minute and a half. And this has been one of the most exciting and lovely conversations that I've had about writing. I look forward to just continuing it a little bit in the webinar. I want to thank this board that and all the people listening. I want to apologize to people who could not get on. I know I'm going to hear about it soon, but you have to call early. You have to call early next week and get in early. The process that we hope to explore next week is that you will bring a piece that you will read an excerpt of about a minute and a half of a piece of your work, and then we can explore why you chose it, why you wrote it, how it was, you know, received in the workshop, and all about the history of it. So I think and I hope that I have whet the appetite of our listeners so that they want to come back and listen to your work next week. And I thank you both for being excellent guests. Really, it's just been my pleasure, absolutely, to host you this evening. And with that said, I'm going to a couple of people just tried to pop on, but we're getting ready to end on this note right now. With that said, I hope to see you both at the webinar in about 2 or 3 minutes. Take a break and sip some water, and we'll continue this whole conversation in a little while.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. You all are both delightful. It's just been absolutely wonderful. Thank you, and exposing me to a whole nother way of looking at what it is that I've been looking at your work a different way, and that's been great for me also. I want to tell the audience that, yes, we will be part two next week, and then after that there is a different guest, but part two and the 100th episode will be next week. So there's lots of celebrations for having you all in. So thank you very much, and we will see you on the radio next week on Lenny Gottfried Straight No Chaser. Thank you, everyone.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby. Hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know how to love you. Far away, you give me fever. When you kiss me, fever.
To prove that mobile from Pantella Data Business Voice brings the office everywhere you are, I'm disconnected with my team while falling 15,000 feet!
We're here, boss. We hear you loud and clear.
Hey, Dennis,
You know, companies today need affordable cloud-based unlimited calling, conferencing, mobile synergy, and easy upgrades to grow with your business to keep you, well, truly mobile.
Pentella Data Business Voice. Anywhere you are.
Janice?
Yeah, boss?
Yeah, I'm going to need a little help.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.